From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, on the hunt in Michigan for minerals on Uncle Sam's wish list.
These minerals are really strategic from the standpoint of maintaining U.S. industry and certainly our defense as well.
The head of the Detroit Zoo on leading the way in conservation and responding to climate change, Ron Kagan, says it all begins with kids.
Kids tend to be very receptive to wanting to do positive things. And after all, they're the ones who are going to inherit Earth and whatever is left of nature.
The challenge in designing autonomous vehicles, us.
We are very distractible beings. So we will back away from paying attention faster than the autonomy can actually handle it.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The federal government is on the hunt for minerals. The Interior Department has drawn up a list of 35 minerals it considers critical to our economy and national security. And now it's handing out grants to researchers to help them find out just how many of these essential minerals they can find. The goal? Stop buying minerals from foreign countries and step up mining here at home. We turn now to Western Michigan University as we say hello to Bill Harrison, Professor Emeritus, who's with the Michigan Geological Survey, where he directs the Michigan Basin Core Research Laboratory, and to Peter Voice, who's a research scientist. His focus is on the history of mining in Michigan. Welcome to the program.
Thanks. We're happy to be here.
Yes, we're happy to be here.
So WMU gets a grant to help figure out if minerals that are deemed important to U.S. national security could be found in Michigan so the nation doesn't have to rely on foreign sources. Bill, did I get that pretty right?
Yes. In fact, this is a response to a congressional report that was published in 2017 by the United States Senate that identified the fact that we are becoming increasingly dependent on foreign sources for a number of important critical minerals that we use in our everyday lives, the minerals that go into producing cell phones, television sets. It's very important in satellite technology. The computers we're using today for this broadcast are related to all those minerals that go into the equipment and machines that we have. So we're really starting to get concerned about that foreign dependency.
Well, we can't list all of the 35 minerals in the government's final list of 35 minerals deemed critical to U.S. national security and the economy. But, Bill, can you give us a few of the most prominent ones, some of the most ones that are pertinent possibly to Michigan?
Well, people have heard of these. A couple of examples, lithium. Lithium, you hear about lithium batteries all the time. Lithium's used in lots of different materials, but one of the key things, because it's such a good conductor and it stores electrons, is in new technology batteries. Cobalt is another one, and actually in most batteries you have an anode and a cathode, which directs the positive and negative currents, and the lithium is at one part and the cobalt is in a different part. So you need both of those elements to be able to construct a lithium battery.
Peter, there is a long, long history here in Michigan of doing these kinds of surveys. Tell us more about them. How do you go about this? And again, building on this long history.
Well, today we gather production statistics from mines through surveys. They send out a questionnaire to the company, and the company will fill out how much they're producing, what they're producing, send it back to the U.S. Geological Survey. And then that data gets compiled and produced as what are referred to as mineral yearbook reports. And so I've been compiling the statistics from those books for the last couple years. Michigan's mining history started in the 1840s, has gone to the present. And in 2013 dollars, the total sum of that production has been about $500 billion.
I suspect because it's kind of out of sight, out of mind, that the average person isn't aware that that $500 billion is a sizable chunk of money. I think most people aren't aware there's such a thriving mining industry in Michigan still.
Oh, yes. We are still actively producing rock salt, gypsum, iron ore, copper. We've produced 1.5 billion metric tons of iron ore from this state.
Hmm. When you think of this list of 35 minerals that the government is particularly interested in, do we have any sense from these, for example, these yearbooks that you've mentioned, Peter, that and its history, whether Michigan does indeed have some of these minerals?
It does. We have actually produced some of these minerals in the past. Potash, which is a source of potassium, was mined here in Michigan for a number of years in the 80s and 90s. It's currently not being mined, but it could be again. We produced manganese from the iron ores. We weren't a huge producer of manganese, but it's an important commodity.
And where in Michigan might these minerals be located?
Well, the main target is the western Upper Peninsula. That's where we have crystalline bedrock present near the surface that hosts a lot of these iron ore and copper ore deposits, and the associated critical minerals would be hosted in those rocks as well. The potash was primarily from the central part of the Lower Peninsula.
Bill Harrison, I've got to ask you, because people are going to have in their minds some environmental concerns. I mean, with this survey, could we ultimately start having multinational mining companies, you know, coming into Michigan communities, taking what is good and profitable out of the ground, and then kind of leaving the cleanup to the local people and to the state?
Well, Michigan is actually one of the national leaders in environmental management. The DEQ has significant body of regulations that manage all of the energy and natural resources that are produced in the state of Michigan. And as Peter mentioned, we've been doing this for a long time here in the state. There is a wide variety of different types of materials that get produced. In addition to the materials that Peter mentioned, there's a new mine up near Marquette that produces copper, produces platinum, and some of the platinum-related elements. Those are also critical elements. That plant, although it took many years to get it licensed and certified, the work between the state of Michigan and the US EPA have really created a historically sophisticated mining operation. It will mine for perhaps a decade or so. It started a few years ago. And when it's all done, you won't even be able to tell it was there. It's amazing how the new technologies in mining have really created an opportunity to have a pretty clean environment once that mining operation is completed. And the companies are bonded to make sure that they're able to clean up any contamination issues that might occur.
Besides jobs, clearly that would be right there up front. In what other ways would Michigan and people in Michigan benefit if we got more mining here? How would we benefit?
Well, there's actually spinoff effect, of course. Anytime you have an industry that develops newly in a community, there's a lot of supporting industries. Energy industry, mechanics, any kind of support facilities. But in addition to that, a lot of these minerals are extracted from state land under state forests, or sometimes in the case of federal land, national forests. And there's actually a royalty that gets paid to the state as a result of that mining. So there is an income. There's also, of course, fees and taxes that come into the treasury. But some portion of the profits from those minerals will actually get plowed back into the state. The example I mentioned of this mine near Marquette, there's actually a lot of the proceeds that are coming to the state from that mine are going back into the local community, into local schools, local parks. So these industries not only generate the natural resources that are important for our society, but they do bring financial benefits to the local regions and also to the state in general.
Peter Voice, since you are, you know, focused on the history of mining in Michigan, I'm sure it wouldn't surprise you to know that for some people, they heard Bill say state forest land, federal forest land, and went, protect that. But and Bill was alluding to the fact that things are done differently now than in the past. Have we learned from the lessons of the past?
Oh, yes. We know a lot more about how to clean up groundwater, how to make sure that we protect the tailings so that they're not being leached and putting harmful contaminants into the water supply. It's a much different world than it was 150 years ago.
How could this survey transform Michigan, Bill Harrison?
Well, we understand a lot about the geology. That's really our job as a geological survey. Our mandate when the geological survey was first created, it was actually the first state agency that got created when Michigan became a state, because the early legislature realized that natural resources can provide enormous potential for growth and development in a particular state. So we continue that today, and all of the different activities related to the natural resources in the state are part of the responsibility of the Geological Survey. We're here at Western Michigan University because we are the group of scientists that have spent the most time and have the most experience looking at Michigan geology. We look at things like the energy systems. We work with oil and gas industry to help them better understand where the potential opportunities are. We work with the Underground Natural Gas Storage Group. Michigan is the state that leads the nation in underground natural gas storage, so that we have a continuous and important supply of natural gas resources. We work with the DEQ and with private industry in terms of the mining activities, and we work with the environmental groups and with the water resource groups to better understand the water resources. Where are our water resources, and how can we best protect those? So the scientific application of the knowledge that we gather about the underground environment in Michigan is beneficial for many activities, but primarily focused around our natural resources.
And ultimately, as you conduct these surveys to see just where Michigan might be able to supply some of these 35 critical minerals, it's clear the Interior Department says this is not a final list. This is going to be ongoing. So this idea of let's focus back on where the domestic sources of these minerals would be could in the long run pay off for Michigan.
Absolutely. The reason these were identified as critical minerals is that the vast majority of them were either 100% or some high proportion dependent on foreign sources. There are many other minerals. There's several hundred that are reported on each year by the U.S. Geological Survey that Peter mentioned that tracks all the production data. But these 35 are the ones that are the most concern when it comes to geopolitical issues. These minerals are really strategic from the standpoint of maintaining U.S. industry and certainly our defense as well.
Work being done by Western Michigan University, where the Michigan Geological Survey boasts Professor Emeritus Bill Harrison and also research scientist Peter Voice. Thanks to both of you for sharing the work that you're doing with us on Stateside.
Thank you very much.
Yes, thank you.
More to come after the break. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. What do you do when you're looking for a certain type of book in the library and you come up empty-handed? No books fit what you need. Well, if you are sisters Zena and Mina Nasiri, you begin to fix the problem by founding a nonprofit group. The problem is their library had no books about Muslim women, and their solution? Founding a nonprofit group they call Girls of the Crescent. And it is a pleasure to welcome Mina and Zena Nasiri. They're from Oakland County, from Rochester Hills, here with us now. Hello, and good to have you here.
Hello. Hi. Thank you for having us.
So, Zena, you are how old?
I'm 16.
And what grade are you in?
I'm in 10th grade.
All right. And Mina?
I'm 14. I'm a freshman.
All right. So you go to Adams High School.
Yes.
So tell us more about, Zena, what happened with kind of this, had a project, went to the library. What was the project and what happened?
So in fourth grade, we were given a research project. We were told to research about someone that we looked up to. And so we went into our local public library. We were really excited to do some research about Muslim women that we looked up to, but we couldn't find any books about them in the biography section. And so we realized that there was this lack of diversity and lack of books about Muslim women.
Now, that's a pretty deep realization for being in grade school. How did that, Zena, lead to you founding the Girls of the Crescent?
In February of 2018, we actually read The Lines We Crossed, which was the first book with the female Muslim main character that we read. And it kind of brought us memories back from fourth grade. And so that inspired us to start our nonprofit, Girls of the Crescent, where we collect books with female Muslim main characters and then donate them to schools and libraries.
Explain the choice of that name, Girls of the Crescent.
So it took us a while to pick the name. We chose Crescent because it's the symbol of Islam and our nonprofit focuses on that religion. And we chose Girls because we're girls helping other girls.
So you're collecting books, Mina. Where do you get the books from?
We order them online. We did a lot of research to see like what books would be good for our list. And we have like a really wide variety. We have biography books and fiction, nonfiction. We have like a really long list on our website. And then we ask libraries and schools what books they don't have or what books they might want. And then we order them and then we ship them to the libraries.
Now, this doesn't come for free. So how are you paying to do all of this work, Zena?
So we have a lot of fundraising that we're doing and that we did do in the past. We did a can and bottle drive in our neighborhood where a lot of neighbors donated. It was really nice to see all the generosity. We also have a lot of people donating on our website, and a lot of authors that we contact donate their own books, which is really nice to see.
Now, I'm interested, when you go to a library, how do you approach the libraries? What do they say?
So we look at libraries in our district. We email them asking them to look at our list of books and see what books they have and what books they don't have. And they're always really excited about our cause.
Well, I think librarians of all people are the ones that are probably looking to open people's minds. And the idea of diversity has to be something that they really want to build into their libraries.
Yeah, a lot of librarians have said like they're starting a diversity section or they're working really hard to get more diverse books. And so when we tell them about our project, they're like, this is perfect for the time right now. We're trying to increase the diversity.
So this started about a year ago. Do you know how many books you've collected and distributed so far?
We've donated about 500 books and we've collected over $4,000.
Okay. And when you say libraries, are we talking school libraries, public libraries? Where are the libraries?
We've donated to public libraries and also like school classrooms, so the individual classrooms in the school.
Now, I have to wonder, I suspect both of you love to read.
Yeah. Yes.
Okay. Did you have any idea how many books were actually out there? How did you start researching and discovering books about Muslim women?
We actually have a lot of people, when we tell them about a project, come up to us and they're really surprised about how many books there actually are. And they're like, oh, how can you do this if there aren't that many books? But there are actually a really wide variety of books. There just isn't awareness or availability. And we were surprised ourselves. Our list is really long and it keeps growing every day.
I did check your website out and you've got quite a great collection.
Yeah.
So I'm curious, you must be reading these as they come in, somewhere within all the homework time you have to do.
Yeah.
So start with you, Mina. Have you found a book that you just said, boy, am I glad I found this book?
Can I mention the first one we read?
Mm-hmm.
It was called The Lines We Cross. The main character actually has the same name that I do. And like that was the first time I've ever seen my name in a book. And it was just a really fun kind of teen romance novel, but it also incorporated the religious part. And it was a really good book.
And what's Zena's favorite book?
That's definitely also my favorite book. But a lot of the children's books are really cute. There's one called Golden Domes and Silver Lanterns, and it's a book about colors, and it's really adorable.
What does it mean, and you started to tell us this, Mina, for you as young Muslim women to see yourselves in a book?
It feels really good. It kind of gives us a sense of like being included, I guess, in society, because if children grow up and they don't see themselves in the media or they don't see themselves in books, it kind of shows like they're not really included or they're not shown in the society. And so the first time we read a book with a character like us, it was just a really great feeling.
Yeah. And what were your feelings, Zena?
Very, very similar to Mina. We both really, really love reading, and we read a ton. It just kind of never occurred to us that we were missing out until we read the first book, and then we realized that our whole lives we had never really seen that, and the other people were probably experiencing the same thing.
And as you're doing this, at this point in our nation's history, you know that there is this sense of unease or even fear and hatred in this country toward some minority communities. How do you think of this work you're doing in Girls of the Crescent in kind of addressing this and promoting inclusiveness and maybe changing mistaken ideas that people might have about Islam?
The books that we are donating provide a window into someone's life that maybe someone isn't very used to or isn't comfortable to because they haven't personally met someone like a female Muslim or just a Muslim person at all. And we've both, Mina and I, have experienced negative stereotypes toward us from classmates in regards to us being Muslim.
Like what?
Recently, it was near Christmas time, and so this kid was asking me, like, what do I do on Christmas? And I said, I don't celebrate it because I'm Muslim and I celebrate something else. And then I got called out. He called me something really bad, and it just felt horrible.
Have you had anything like that happen?
I had a classmate tell me that I was lucky that I hadn't had my hands cut off because I wasn't living in the Middle East.
How does that make you feel?
It's really disheartening, and it's just really unpleasant because you feel like you don't belong, and that people having these negative stereotypes are usually a result of ignorance, and it's an easily fixable problem if they're just educated, and it's just really sad that they aren't.
Yeah, so when you think about these books that you're putting in, you're sowing seeds, aren't you, that maybe some first or second grader, before these ideas are formed, may read that book. And at least, as you say, it's like opening this door. So this is really as much for young people who are Muslim, like you are, who wanted to see yourself, as it is for people who don't really know what it's about. Do you think it's even more for the people who don't know what being Muslim is about and don't understand Islam?
Yeah, I think that's a really big part of it. We're trying to like educate them, trying to show them like Muslim people and Muslim women. And especially, like you said, if children read about these books, if they see like a character with a hijab or a character from a Middle Eastern country, they realize like, oh, this person is like me. This person has similar experiences, and they don't grow up being ignorant. They don't grow up with those biases.
Well, you can learn more about Mina and Zina Nasiri's work by going to their website. It's very easy to find, girlsofthecrescent.org. Again, girlsofthecrescent.org. List of books, list of ways to get involved. And, you know, who knows what kind of seeds that you've planted now and where that may take you. Thank you so much for speaking with us about your work.
Thank you.
Thank you.
There's this idealized image of the future of autonomous vehicles seamlessly zipping us from point A to point B while we read a book, take a nap, or watch a movie. But we admit it, have a ways to go before we achieve that utopian vision. Last year, for instance, a pedestrian was struck and killed by an autonomous vehicle that was being tested out in Phoenix by Uber. And a recent study from the Georgia Institute of Technology tells us there is a potential risk with self-driving vehicles. They may be better at sensing and detecting pedestrians with lighter skin tones. Well, this has researchers searching for ways to make these autonomous vehicles safer. Researchers like my guest, Walter Lisecki, assistant professor of computer science and engineering at the University of Michigan. Great to have you with us, Walter.
Thanks for having me on.
So you're working on a project that combines human and artificial intelligence in autonomous vehicles. What is the driving question or problem behind your research?
Well, so as we know, driving is extremely dangerous, right? And yet, at the same time, it's not something that we can, like smoking, for instance, just tell people to stop doing, because it's incredibly important for our productivity, for our happiness. So instead, we're thinking of this as more of a holistic system. So you already have drivers in the car, right?
Uh-huh.
And when you have these humans that are part of this process already, what we want to be able to do is combine what they know about what's going on around them potentially, or what they understand from a scene, in a way that allows us to get over these little failure points in autonomy. So right now, we're not going to have fully autonomous vehicles, as you mentioned. So instead of just saying we will wait until the system is perfect, we want to deploy something that is both effective but also as safe as possible. So we're trying to hand off the moment-to-moment control of a vehicle that may suddenly switch from autonomous mode to help, I need help from a human driver, without necessarily requiring the person in the car to be that respondent.
Okay. Because we know if you're just driving on a uncrowded road and there's not much going on, we're probably pretty much there. The car can handle that. It's the, oh my word,
exactly.
These exceptional moments. And so you're trying to figure out a way to keep things safe there. And when you think about there are certainly a number of levels between me being completely in control and driving and me reading a book or taking a nap while this autonomous vehicle does all the driving. So you know, where are we now as far as the gradation, the levels?
Right. So there is kind of a formal specification of these different levels of autonomy that they have in autonomous vehicle research. Going from level zero, so there's six levels. You're going from level zero, which is none at all.
Which is my daily drive, an hour and a half each way. So
exactly.
That's the none at all.
No, that's the none at all. You know, and that slowly moves up towards things like cruise control. So level one would be simple control of part of the driving experience. So cruise control allows you to not worry about the exact pressure that you're putting on the pedal in order to maintain a speed, and you can just steer the car. What's new is level two, where we're starting to look at essentially fancy cruise control. We can take over more than just one element of control of the car. This is what you see in GM's Super Cruise or Tesla's Autopilot, right, where you can actually take your hands off of the wheel and the car will navigate itself for short periods of time, but you're expected to be kind of hovering over at all times to make sure it's doing the right thing. That continues to progress, you know, get more and more automated as we hit level 3, which focuses on driverless autonomy of the car, but you're still supposed to have a driver paying attention to the road, because while you don't need to be moment to moment waiting for something to go wrong, when the car realizes that it doesn't know what to do, it's going to hand back control. Mm. And of course, critical events on the road might happen with only a couple seconds of lead time. I realize something entered the lane. I don't know what it is as the autonomous vehicle. And so immediately we just pop back control to the human.
Of course, can I ask if that's what where the Uber car in the Uber test car in Phoenix was at?
Yeah, so it was somewhere between kind of
two and three.
Okay. Yeah. The problem that it was mostly that they were testing it in kind of a level 3 mode, but the driver, the human driver, wasn't paying attention. Mm-hmm. Right. So they weren't able to intervene when there was a problem. There's some evidence that they did have an unknown object entering the road. And that turned out, unfortunately, to be a person, and the car did not account for that.
Okay. Then moving up to level 4.
So level 4 is you really can stop paying attention to the road, but only in certain scenarios. So when you get on the highway, you know, you can climb in the back seat for a nap, is the dream anyway of level 4, okay. But only on the highway. So you can't handle other scenarios. It might be only on the highway when, you know, it's sunny outside and the weather's good and no other complications come online. And then 5 is kind of the ultimate dream of self-driver cars. We can uninstall the steering wheel and the pedals, and you just get into a mobile living room. But we are quite far away from that, despite, you know, I think what people are starting to hope for, seeing these level 2 and level 3 features rolled out and tested.
Okay, so we've got a sense, and it'll certainly, as you say, be a while before we're on that rolling living room.
Yes.
in the back. So this technique that you call instantaneous crowdsourcing fits into all of this discussion of self-driving vehicles and safety. How does it fit in?
So up to this point, all of those levels that I've described assume that the person goes from driving the car entirely themselves to slightly less and less attention paid to the road as we get better autonomy, better artificial intelligence. But even this breakdown assumes that it will still be the person in the car who is ultimately responsible for doing something about the critical event that comes up if it's a level 3 car, or are overseeing the navigation if it's in level 2, kind of fancy cruise control mode. Now, the problem with that is we are very distractible beings. So we will back away from paying attention faster than the autonomy can actually handle it. And you get this, like you mentioned, like driving long periods of time, right? Where you're staring at the road for an hour, 2 hours, 3 hours, and you just glaze over. And that's bad enough. But now when you believe that the car is just going to take care of it, kind of gives you this internal narrative that it's okay to not pay attention. And the last time it probably worked, I reached for something in the passenger seat, and then eventually I checked my phone. And, you know, in the Arizona accident, it was somebody staring down at their lap, paying too much attention to their phone to intervene. And what we know from thinking about how humans interact with computers is that we're not good when you surprise us. You can't just say, you know, suddenly, here's something you have to pay attention to. Oh, also, it's an incredibly stressful situation that's too complex.
And you've been reading a book or doing whatever.
And you've been reading a book. You don't even know that you're on a highway exit or whatever the scenario happens to be. So now you have to look up, page that all back in, and then make a reasonably complex decision in a moment's notice. And even if you can do that, you're probably not ready to page everything back in.
Okay.
And certainly for the everyday motorist, this is going to be considerably more challenging than I think people have it in mind when they start using these features.
So this project you're working on tries to address that gap, that problem.
Exactly. So in work that was recently published just last year, we have the first way to combine multiple people's input to outperform what any person could possibly accomplish on a low-level task. So, you know, imagine grabbing the wheel and steering left around an obstacle. So we can do that level of task faster than your nervous system itself can respond.
B- building that into the computer controlling the car.
Exactly. We call that instantaneous crowdsourcing. So we have a crowd of people, multiple people, who we can draw in to help with this task, and we can actually collectively act faster than we could alone. And we're using this to hand off control of these control of the car in critical events that just suddenly pop up, and the system, the driving the car, realizes, I don't know what's going on here. We now can intervene with someone who is a professional driver in, you know, imagine a call center, kind of like what was backing OnStar when GM had OnStar in vehicles. And so now we can actually potentially answer, deal with this request faster than the driver in the car ever could. The hope would be that we could have professional drivers who are experts at switching contexts and experts at thinking about situational awareness on the road because they've been experienced drivers. So maybe truck drivers, you know, you hear a lot about autonomous trucks coming onto the market and kind of changing the work and employment landscape for long-haul truck drivers. You know, these are people who also have a lot of road experience. So we can start to think about, and my team has been doing a little bit of this, think about how using that expertise in a different way could keep, you know, daily commuters more safe.
Walter Lisecki is an assistant professor of computer science and engineering at the University of Michigan, working on autonomous vehicle research that combines human and artificial intelligence. Fascinating work. Thank you so much for sharing it with us.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Coming up, the Detroit Zoo is one of the greenest in the nation, thanks in large part to the leadership of CEO Ron Kagan. After the break, how Michigan's largest zoo is helping build awareness of humans' impact on the earth. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. There's a lot of reason to feel overwhelmed and powerless in the face of environmental and conservation challenges. But there are those who are leading community conversations about conservation and climate change through education and also by example. One group working to that end, the Detroit Zoo. For the past 16 years, the Detroit Zoo has done strategic planning around green efforts. In fact, the Detroit Zoo was recognized as one of the greenest zoos in the U.S. for its sustainability initiatives. Here's my conversation with Ron Kagan, CEO of the Detroit Zoological Society. So, Ron, when did you know that teaching about climate change would be an important part of the mission of the Detroit Zoo?
Probably about 20 years ago, when a lot of us in the conservation community began to see some strange developments. I mean, literally, climate change had already started to affect wildlife populations. So for us, it wasn't any more a theoretical discussion. We began to realize it was a real issue and already having an impact.
What were some of those examples that you could tell us?
Well, so one of the things that was happening is we saw in Antarctica, for instance, Adelie penguins, populations were dwindling along the Antarctic Peninsula. And this became kind of a detective mystery. We know that krill, which are these sort of miniature shrimp that are in the oceans all over the world and really feed so much of aquatic life in oceans, that krill were disappearing from some of these areas, which the krill are eaten by the penguins, not just penguins, but by Adelie penguins. They were disappearing. We also were seeing Adelie penguin nests that were beginning to melt right when the chicks were hatching. And the Adelies are hardwired. They don't sort of look at a problem and go, okay, well, I guess we need to move to a colder area. These are breeding areas that they've been to for probably millions of years. So a lot of chicks were not surviving. So you begin to see things which normally in nature don't happen quickly. And by quickly, I mean over the course of several years. Normally changes, again, unless there is a meteor that hits Earth or there are a whole bunch of volcanoes that explode, you don't see changes like this happening quickly. And we saw that happening just over the course of a few years, that there were some major population changes happening.
Give us an idea of some of the initiatives that you've brought to the zoo and have the zoo doing that kind of bring this idea of climate change and conservation to the forefront? Just maybe people don't even realize they're getting kind of preached to as they go through the zoo.
Well, we do. It's interesting you use that word. We do want to avoid sounding preachy. Mm-hmm. We do want to help people understand important issues. And they are issues that are shared by humans and non-humans, non-human animals as well. So there are quite a few things that we do. And to some extent, we try to bring people on a journey with us because we've been on a journey, and we call it the Green Print Journey. Actually, people can go to our website at DetroitZoo.org, and they can download our Green Print. They can download something that they can actually put in their wallets called Shades of Green, which gives them dozens of examples of things that we all can do in our daily lives. But we have, for instance, Science on a Sphere, which was developed by NOAA and NASA. And it shows Earth, and in both real time and accelerated time, we can show what's been happening, what's going to happen. We're only one of two zoos in the world that has it, and it's a very powerful tool because one of the things that it can do is compress time. And for humans, unless you see cause and effect immediately, people sometimes don't really understand the connection of what we do and what the impact is. And Science on a Sphere can accelerate time so that you can actually see very quickly what's been happening, for instance, to the polar ice caps, which is an obvious example of global warming. But we also have a smart flower, which is, again, one of only two in the country, actually, and a very interesting solar device that tracks the sun. And it's always at maximum attack angle, so it's 40% more efficient than any solar device can be.
Hmm.
And it's right in the center on the mall, so people immediately are drawn to this. It's such an unusual device. And we explain what's going on. We explain renewable energy. We do the same with water. So we have lots and lots of filtered water filling stations, and we don't sell plastic water bottles at the zoo and have them for many years. We have a beautiful Michigan wetlands boardwalk, and the whole boardwalk is made out of recycled plastic bottle caps. I can go on and on. There are just so many different things throughout the anaerobic digester, which takes our 1 million pounds of animal waste, converts it into methane, which then powers a generator, which then powers our animal health complex. And all of these things have educational components to them so that it's not just what we're doing, but we're explaining to our 1.4 million visitors a year, which is the key, because there are lots of great environmental organizations, but very few actually have direct contact with so many people every year. So for us, it's both a responsibility and a great opportunity to try to get people to understand issues and especially solutions.
And do you feel that the kind of messages that you've just shared with us, that the zoo is demonstrating at all times, you think that's reaching groups who might otherwise tune it out or shrug it off, the issues of climate change and conservation?
Well, it's difficult. When you do studies and evaluations of visitors, you can generally get a sense of before and after a visit, but not long after a visit. That's really tough.
Hmm.
And as we all know, all of us are bombarded with lots of messages. And in some cases, there are messages that are meant to confuse the public about climate change, which is really a tragedy because we don't have any time left. I mean, you know, during the past five mass extinction events, generally, anywhere from 65 to 85% of all species have become extinct. Now, new species evolve, but normally that recovery takes 10 to 30 million years. Obviously, humans don't have 10 to 30 million years to recover.
Sure.
And we're now in the Anthropocene, and we potentially will lose a million species before the century is out. That will take millions of years to recover from, and the question is, will we even be able to withstand that?
And when you think of the severity and the implications of climate change, how do you strike a balance between these realities and educating kids in particular about climate change without scaring them?
Well, you know, to your point, we don't want to preach.
Right.
You know, people don't come to public places for that. And so this is really, it is about facts. It is about trying to focus on solutions, trying to help people understand the connectivity of all things on Earth. And there really are things that can be done. Some of this is complicated, and that is a real challenge. You know, climate science is extremely complicated. Even the climate experts have lots of challenges of explaining the differences of what methane does in the atmosphere and what CO2 does and carbon sequestration. And I mean, there are a lot of complicated elements to all of this. But I think the one thing that we're able to do is people love nature. And we try to, of course, encourage that and foster that and try to encourage people to be more thoughtful about how every step we take, literally and figuratively, can have an impact. And it can have a positive impact, but it also can have a negative impact. Kids tend to be very receptive to wanting to do positive things. And after all, they're the ones who are going to inherit Earth and whatever is left of nature. So there are many, many things that all of us can do differently, that some of them are small and they all add up. It's a little bit like voting. People that don't vote because they say, well, my vote isn't really going to count because there are millions of people. If enough people do that, then democracy doesn't work.
If you've just joined us, I'm speaking with the CEO of the Detroit Zoological Society, Ron Kagan. You have been to Antarctica, Ron. Why did you go? And tell us what that experience was like for you. What really stuck with you from that visit?
Well, I've been to Antarctica now 6 times. And in fact, while this is anecdotal, it certainly supports the evidence. Over the course of the past 25 or 30 years, I have seen dramatic changes in Antarctica. And it is as close, I think, as you can get to traveling to another world. The scale of things, the extreme nature of the environment is incredible. But at the same time, that's one of the ways that we visually can see dramatic changes with climate, because the polar ice caps are shrinking, and they're shrinking dramatically, especially the north, but also in Antarctica. Antarctica is a place where we work with a scientist at the Palmer Station. There are 3 U.S. stations in Antarctica. He's been doing ecological research there for over 40 years, and we've been working with him now for probably 6 or 7 years. He's been documenting for the entire time that he's been there the ecological changes in Antarctica. It is still a spectacular place, but it is changing so quickly.
And I know that the state-of-the-art penguin facility at the Detroit Zoo, it's like an interactive trip to Antarctica for the folks who go there. Was it designed, Ron, with the intention of drawing people into both the positive and negative impacts of human beings on the natural world around them?
What a wonderful question, because that's exactly what we did. So, in fact, the exterior of the building evokes images of a tabular iceberg. In fact, when Bill Fraser, the scientist I was just telling you about, first saw the design, he said, "When were you at my research station?" And we said, "Well, actually, this isn't from there, but it is from Antarctica, and it's cracking in half. That's what you see." And that is evoking the concept that we are losing ice, and that is problematic. I think the other thing is that not only do we have lots of messaging in that facility, but we also at the end have opportunities for people to take action that will help the environment and do the reverse. So you're given options of, for instance, you know, if we all ate less meat, there'd be a lot less methane that goes into the atmosphere. Methane traps the heat like it's a heat blanket that's far more damaging actually than CO2. It just doesn't last as long as the atmosphere in the atmosphere. So we could dramatically reduce methane, which comes from all of the dairy industry, if we use less dairy products. And there are lots of choices you can make using recycled bags and many other things, turning off lights when you leave a room. I mean, some of these things sound very small, but they all add up. And so in the Polk Center, we make sure that you are excited about Antarctica. We take you there via Sir Ernest Shackleton's ship, the Endurance, which is an incredible experience.
It is, yeah.
And he was a hero of mine from, I don't know, I think I was probably eight when I read his story. But it's an incredible experience and gets people very, very interested. And, of course, the penguins are spectacular. And so, again, this is partly drawing people in to remind them of biophilia, the innate love of nature that humans have, and then trying to encourage them to think about what the impacts are of our daily lives and the various things we can do to help and minimize the human impact on climate change.
Looking into the future, Ron, how do you want Detroit's zoo to lead conservation efforts and climate change awareness?
Well, I'm happy to say that we've been recognized with a number of very wonderful awards, including being named the greenest zoo in the United States by the Association of Zoos and Aquariums. I think that whatever we do, and we have four main mission pillars, sustainability is one of them, animal welfare is another, education is another, and conservation is the other one. Whatever we do, we want to have the most impact possible. There are many things we can't and shouldn't do. It's not our expertise. So we don't focus on tropical animals because we're not in the right climate for that. But in terms of sustainability, I don't know that there's anything more pressing for a conservation organization to work on. And this absolutely connects to the biodiversity challenge. And people need to understand that, you know, nature is very complicated and things really are connected. And every time we lose a species or lose a habitat, things begin to break down. I don't remember who it was who said this years ago, but you can think of it as a metaphor of a plane. And a plane can lose a whole bunch of rivets and still fly, but then it's that one last rivet, and then the whole thing unravels. I don't know if we're at a tipping point, but we're in a lot of trouble. Mm-hmm. We already know that temperatures have rised over 1.5 degrees Celsius. We're probably on track to go up as much as 3 degrees Celsius, which is enormous and will really be devastating. Climate change obviously is affecting sea levels. If all of the ice melts on Antarctica, sea levels around the world will go up 200 feet. I mean, it's kind of mind-boggling numbers.
It is, indeed. Ron, let's end on this note. What signs have you found that are encouraging, positive changes that have happened or give you hope for the future?
Well, I think, not surprisingly, the young people give us a lot of hope. I do think we aren't where we could or should be with respect to governmental policies, at least not in the U.S. I mean, there are isolated places that really have taken this very seriously, others that don't seem to really want to believe it. And I, you know, to me, the notion of what not believing facts doesn't really make any sense. But I think that it's the young people. You know, we need to encourage kids, and we need to get into schools, both in formal and informal science education. We obviously are not the only ones doing this. I think most science institutions, science museums, aquariums, zoos, all need to do a lot. We should not be strictly focused on animals. We should be really focused on the bigger picture.
Ron Kagan is the CEO of the Detroit Zoological Society, and it certainly seems like the message is individuals do have the power to affect change. You can go to DetroitZoo.org to learn more about Greenprint, Shades of Green, and so many other initiatives at the Detroit Zoo. Ron, thank you so very, very much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And we always love to hear from you. What stories or people are you focused on, or issues that you want to hear more about? Let us know. You can find us on Facebook, search for Michigan Radio. We're on Twitter at Stateside Radio, or send us an email to stateside@michiganradio.org. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Today's contributors are Mercedes Mejia, April Van Buren, Mike Blank, Laura Weber-Davis, Adam Reyes, Tad Davis, and Catherine Newhan. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.